From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a conversation with Professor Tony Montero about the 2020 election, reparations, and a lot more. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you very much, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I want to start. There was this polling data starting to come out again. We're looking about a year and change away from the conventions. I don't know what month they're going to hold them, but generally July and August are when they hold the major party conventions. And I saw these polls last weekend, including a Fox poll that indicate that Biden, of course, they're really pushing Biden, beats Trump. Warren beats Trump. I don't know if Skippy the elephant beats Trump, whatever. Everybody beats Trump in a matchup. Yeah. And, of course, the Biden is, you know, the front runner. I understand he had a hard time turning out 2,000 people last month at his campaign kickoff. And Trump the other night had 20,000-seat hall packed 3-4 times over, apparently.
Well, just on that Biden thing, because it was here in Philadelphia, he had problems getting out 200 people. So
it seemed like he had that many on the stage. They didn't show you, they didn't cruise the crowd in any of the, I even saw a raw video that apparently somebody told them don't do that. And, I know a few days within that event, each of them were in Pittsburgh. And apparently there was a reporter from the Gannett Daily in Delaware that gave an estimate of 600 for Biden's. And Trump, again, you know, filled some arena with 20,000 people or whatever. So what we're seeing is a replay to me of what happened before the last election, because I took a look at the polls that were published in mid-June of 2015, which, again, was about a year before the conventions, you know, exactly 4 years to the day on one of these polls, as a matter of fact. They had 15 or so Republican candidates. Trump came in 11th with 1%. And Clinton, Jeb Bush, first of all, was on top of the heap by a good distance. And it showed Clinton and Jeb Bush basically as the two candidates, with Clinton slightly ahead, but you know, definitely ahead of Bush, that Clinton was going to be, you know, crowned. And this was Chuck Todd and a couple of the other geniuses, you know, making proclamations, sitting on top of this data, you know, about how, what a cakewalk it was going to be for her. And I'm looking at the same thing replayed. They didn't learn anything.
Right. And they're not going to learn anything because they are blinded by their class interest and their separation. And it is getting wider from the masses of people. You know, the masses of American people are complex. It's a complex organism. It's not one thing. You know, and people, when it gets to the level of people's values, people's interests and how they define their economic and social and political interests and their religious views and other ideological views. You know, it's a very complex thing. And the Democrats, who seem to not be able to break out of identity politics, are unable, at least at the level of the elites of the Democratic Party, to really understand the people. And no matter what they do, they always go back to these polls. And these polls are very cheap and, as we now know, very inaccurate way of trying to gauge the pulse of the people. So the polls are pretty much useless, and even more so at this stage in the game. Right. But I think the people are not paying attention yet. They are upset with the way the country is governed. They are upset with neoliberal capitalism. And we do know, and I think this might be accurate, that almost 50% of the people and more among young people prefer what they feel is socialism over neoliberal capitalism. But the ruling class is, by its reliance on these polls, by its almost hysterical reliance on these polls, is kind of saying to me that they realize that they're increasingly unable to manage or govern the people and this nation.
You know, it's interesting. The science, quote unquote, of propaganda and of mass manipulation, the technology of delivering messaging, these are all at the pinnacle in human history, and it's kind of hard to imagine anything, you know, more intensive than each person carrying around a small box that interprets reality for them, you know, moment to moment, which is pretty much where we are now. These phones and things that people look at, you know, you get in, go into a room with four people, none of them are talking to each other. They're talking to other people through this box. In other words, being mediated by somebody else. So what I mean, what you're talking about with propaganda, with you know, these different means of manipulating opinion, is manipulating the interpretation of reality, not the reality itself, and then thereby hoping to influence how people behave in the real world.
Right, absolutely.
It's a difference. It's a distinction in philosophy between, you know, the apparent and the real, or, you know, the apparent and the essential. With having reached the pinnacle of this, you can have all kinds of stuff swirling around in people's brains while they watch one of the 2,000 channels that they have that microcast to them. If their stomach is empty, no matter what the TV or their little box is telling them that means, somewhere they know they're hungry. And these tools have been used to intensify the exploitation of workers to the point where everyone is in a precarious situation. Regardless of how they're interpreting it, they also know that. And so these polls that don't ask about those things, we noticed that last time, all of the polls that were saying that Trump had no chance, we were looking at, you brought it here first, the first person I heard discuss it at all, we were looking at a working class uprising in the 2016 election. And if you looked at the polls, nobody mentioned employment, jobs, worker, working class, nothing in any of the polls. Nobody asked them about the things that were going to motivate them to vote.
That's right. And the assumption, the assumptions were that most people are pretty much satisfied with the way things are.
Right.
Now, in the 2020 election, the upcoming election, they've kind of gotten a little bit away from that, that people are satisfied. That's why the Democrats are, you know, putting on these shows about how much they're concerned with the people and their radical proposals they're making about how they will change things and make things better. So they know there's dissatisfaction, and they're trying to speak to that dissatisfaction, while at the same time recognizing that the majority of people do not see any politicians as authentic, as legitimate, as trustworthy.
That's right.
And so, you know, I wouldn't want to be them, i.e. the what I call the super managerial elites. I wouldn't want to be them by any means, because they're faced with a contradiction, and it is the fundamental contradiction that has always moved history forward, that between the masses of people and the their rulers. And that's what they're faced with. I don't think they can mediate it. It can only get deeper, and the crisis of legitimacy, where the people don't trust the media, don't trust the politicians, don't trust the major institutions of the society, and really want something different, and are waiting for a new kind of leadership, a new kind of movement to come forward that will make that realizable in concrete terms.
You know, I don't know what the terminology is in 2019 speak, you know, in a place where cultural Marxism and, you know, all these other, you know, the Democrats are of the left, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Okay, but in the old days, we used to call the kind of contradiction that, that is coming with this the dialectical nature of things. And that is that the more intensive and successful the project to exploit people is, the more intensively it generates the opposition to it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And that's what we're seeing, actually. Yep. I mean, the and I put quotes, the most perfect form of exploitation under capitalism is the neoliberal form.
So far, for sure.
It is, yeah, it perfected all previous attempts or manners or ways of exploitation. This is the most sophisticated because it kind of makes it into a world system, and it makes all workers pretty much be at the same level of a declining and austere a situation of life.
Yeah.
And so that's why you get trillion-dollar corporations and billionaire individuals emerging all over the place. But as you put it, I agree with you. It just widens the gap and between the people and the ruling elites and ruling class, and it deepens the contradiction between the two sides.
You know, you were mentioning before identity politics and the fact that the you know, the Democratic Party, for example, but I think the political structures generally, because I think we'll see this in the Republican Party too, with opposition to Trump.
Right.
That they're fishing, you know, they're looking for, you know, something that is going to, you know, hook this dissatisfaction that's going to represent the dissatisfaction. But of course, the goal is not to actually end the source of the dissatisfaction, because that's the source of exploitation, that's the node of exploitation. So you look at the Democratic candidates right now, for example, it's like the village people. It's, you know, they've got, there's a, you know, like a micro-casted attempt in the body of each person. Here's the gay one, here's the female one, here's the, you know, this one and that. They even have an anti-war one, you know, an official anti-war one. Mike Gravel, for example, an actual anti-war one, keeps seeing that all the rules change around him, so he can't get onto the stage in the debates. They've got, I don't know, what, 15, 20 people or whatever that are going to participate in this. And the guy who read the Pentagon Papers into the public record and made it possible to publish them without people going to prison doesn't have standing to participate in that conversation. Right. And he was a governor, okay? I'm sorry, a senator from Alaska. And you got a guy who's mayor of South Bend, Indiana. You know, right now, his political experience consists of looking at parking tickets and sewage plants. Okay, he's going to make public policy. He's going to make foreign policy. He's going to understand how to parse what's happening between India, China, Russia, and Pakistan, for example. You know, it's sort of like when you go to bingo and Mary and Bob and Sue argue. I go down there and mediate it every Thursday night.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Gravel, though, there's no room for him on the stage. So it looks like a diverse, that's my point. It looks like there's a diversity of candidates because, like I said, you've got the gay one, the female one, this one, that one. There's the male black one, the female black one, one of just about everybody, but they're all exactly the same in essence. It's like the facets are where the diversity exists, the presentations, the apparent, but the actual, the material, the essential is the same. They're going to serve the same people that brought us here.
Right. And, you know, one thing that the village people, the rock group from back in the days, one thing that they had that these 24 Democrats don't have, at least they had a worker in there.
Right,
you
that's
know?
Right, that's right.
We don't have that these days. But I do agree with you. It is cheap politics. It is, and by cheap politics, politics without substance, without ideology,
right,
without conviction, without commitment. You know, I was following the reparations hearings yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday at the House of Representatives. And again, it was a form of cheap politics. And the proposals, to the extent that there were proposals, were a pretty conservative in a time where a good part of the black community, and I would suggest over 50%, are favorable towards socialism. What we saw is this show, this performance, where they were talking about reparations without fundamentally transforming capitalist economics. So, you know, the political economy of reparations was never brought into the discussion.
Right.
So it was cheap politicking. It was a way for the Democrats to say, look, we're on the side of black people and we're for economic, we seek to redress the economic inequalities, but they really don't. And it's just like the whole Democratic array of candidates. They will promise everything until the election is over, and if they get elected, they will give you nothing.
You know, there's two things on this. I'm glad I have an opportunity to actually mouth this out loud. Number one is the in terms of this ever getting out of the House and past the Senate. It's a perfect setup politically because it's never going to make it past the Senate. There's nothing to make past the Senate. This is
absolutely
political, not really a political economy, not really a material proposal that's going to come out. God forbid. Mm-hmm. The House doesn't want that any more than the Senate. But it's going to look like this. But if you were actually looking at doing these things, first of all, you start looking at models of things that people have used before. And I would look first at the voucher privatization that was done in the Soviet Union when it was broken up, where essentially they looked at all of the socialist economy that had been constructed, the entities, you know, the corporations, whatever, and theoretically everybody got a proportional share in them as they privatized it. And what ended up happening is, like, within a month or so, five or six guys ended up owning everything. It was a big hustle.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
one thing. Another, though, is the thing that really gets me is when you take a look at the Democrats and Republicans, how it breaks down, consider a couple of facts. First of all, this is for slavery and Jim Crow, correct? Okay, and so that Jim Crow ends legally. It still hasn't ended practically. They might work on that while they're talking about money, but ends legally in the mid-60s with the legislation that was passed then. At the time of slavery and up to the very last few years, it was the Democratic Party that was the party of slavery and segregation.
Yes.
Not the Republican Party. So if we were going to do payment for, you know, reparations for that damage institutionally, who should be writing the check, the Democrats or the Republicans?
But it's systemic. And unless neither the Democrats or the Republicans are prepared to look at the system itself and transform the system. And that's, you know, everything kind of boils down to that right now. There's very little room to reform the system. The neoliberal capitalist model is probably the highest stage of the development of capitalism.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Which means they've already stolen the most money.
Yeah.
They're not going to pay the reparations. There's some illusion that if they can find 10 white people, quote unquote, that still have any money, they're going to take it to distribute it among black people, quote unquote, and then they're going to take that too.
Yeah.
I mean, they've already taken everything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No. So unless there is a radical transformation of this model of capitalism,
right,
and thus, you know, you're not going back to an earlier form of capitalism. You have to go forward to something that is not capitalism any longer.
That's right.
I mean, now that's the great political and ideological task before us, those of us who claim to be radicals and revolutionaries. We have to find ways to develop that type of debate and thinking among the masses of people. We have to present another option except trying to solve what are unsolvable problems under capitalism, right. How to solve those problems by going beyond capitalism.
Exactly.
I mean, that, you know, that's where we're at. Everything else is a joke and cheap politics and symbolic politics. You know, in a moment where identity politics doesn't work the way it did for a couple of decades, and therefore all sides are going to have to look at something more fundamental in transforming the system.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, again, you reach a tipping point.
A tipping point, I agree with that. Or as they sometimes call it, a moment of truth.
Yeah.
Or a turning point in history. Mm. That is why, you know, you and I, from 2015 and 2016 onward, we have kept our eyes on the working people. What are they doing? How are they thinking? What are their attitudes towards the political system and the major agents of political power in this country? And that's where, when you look at it from that standpoint, from that class positioning, things look vastly different than if you look at it from the standpoint of this candidate or the other candidate or what the polls say or so on and so forth. What substantively are the masses of people thinking and what are their attitudes? And, you know, in that regard, you know, here in Philly, we've carried out a lot of political education.
Mm.
And, this year is the 150th anniversary of the birth of Mahatma Gandhi. And we're doing a year of activity to celebrate that, but not Gandhi in himself, Gandhi in relationship to the great anti-colonial struggle of India and Asia and Africa,
right.
And the ongoing business of completing the anti-colonial struggle, of going to the next stage of the anti-colonial struggle, and how the anti-colonial struggle of India attracted into its orbit the civil rights movement, and hence the Martin Luther Kings and the James Lawsons, and we could, you know, just so many African Americans who traveled to India to meet with Gandhi and other leaders of the anti-colonial struggle and to see what was valuable in their experience for us here in the United States. I mean, it's that type of political education, because without the masses of people having a new way of seeing their reality and their futures, very little will change. Because, you know, if I might just say this, and I don't mean to be unfair to anybody, but the left is in a deep, almost existential crisis. And you, E.A. Don, you remember that after the election of November 2016, all of the left rose up and was claiming that we've entered the neo-fascist moment, that right. We have to join with the Democrat Party and the liberals and the FBI and the CIA right. And the deep state to get Trump out of office.
Right.
And we resisted that. And those who went along that line, they are in a political and ideological crisis, an existential crisis, I would suggest.
Yeah, I think so, too. Because now what?
Now what? Absolutely.
And not for, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what
ahead.
Now what is
go for
Joe
it.
Biden.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, first of all, the Democrats had as a rallying cry against George Bush in 2004, anybody but Bush. And we ended up with Kerry, and mm-hmm. with Kerry, we ended up with Bush.
Right.
they were saying the same thing going into the primaries in 2015, and they got anybody but Bush. You know who they got? They got Trump. Now it's Absolutely. Anybody but Trump. What comes out of that?
Trump.
That's right. I think so too.
Trump.
And you know, let me just on the point of India, okay?
Yeah,
and
yes.
Gandhi. There are people that, because you made the distinction between who Gandhi was and what Gandhi represented in the motion of history in the anti-colonial movement.
Yes.
There are people who will completely disregard the latter in favor of him. Oh, he was a racist. Oh, he was this, that, the other thing. Mm-hmm. What happened in 1947 was that 400 million people, or about 10% of the human population at the time, was liberated from British rule. And that was something like half of the population of the British Empire at the time.
Absolutely.
And that was perhaps one of the most significant things, that and the Chinese Revolution, that happened in the 20th century, including the two world wars.
Oh, yeah. No, this is... First of all, that claim, those claims, I should say, are quintessentially pro-imperialist, pro-colonialist claims. Gandhi was the leader of the anti-colonial struggle in India. He was not the only leader, but he was the recognized by all sides as the principal leader of the anti-colonial struggle.
Yep.
He was trusted by the Indian masses in ways that few, if any, leaders in history of any movements have been trusted by a leader of their movement. And there's a reason for that. He is considered the father of India by most Indians for a reason. Now, for a Britisher or an American, especially for a Britisher, of course, to claim in the 2000s, in the 21st century, that he was a racist, that he was a casteist, that he was a sexist, that he was a pedophile, whatever they want to say, without evidence, is a sign that in the West, most people, certainly most so-called progressives and liberals, are not prepared to give up Western or white hegemony over the world. If there is a leader of Britain or of the United States, and I'm not talking about Martin Luther King or the civil rights or labor movement leaders, if there is a leader of either of these nations that come anywhere close to Gandhi, I'd like to meet him. The West has not produced leadership of this caliber. And I include among them Napoleon or Hitler or whoever else you'd like to bring out of the woodwork.
Right.
He is a great leader, and he inspired anti-colonial movements throughout the world, including in Vietnam and Ho Chi Minh, including in Africa, and Kwame Nkrumah and Nelson Mandela. And dare we speak of the deep and profound impact upon the civil rights movement.
Right.
And that is a story that needs to be known, needs to be taught, because I think if we know the truth, the truth can help us to understand how we, the people, organize and move to resolve the crisis that we, the people, are in at this time. Let us understand Gandhi and try to imitate Gandhi and the anti-colonial movement. And if we do something like that, we might be further down the road to liberating ourselves.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And on that note, we've got to close it. Professor Montero, pleasure.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.